Redevelopment Authority Citizens Committee and Historic Resources Commission meeting on Monday, December 3rd, 2018. Can we have a roll call?
RAC members, can you hear me? My microphone's not working.
Yeah, we're here.
RAC members, Chair Cardinal.
Here.
Vice Chair Justice.
Here.
Member Barrett.
Here.
Member Hanneman.
Here.
Member Powell. Member Smith.
Here.
HARC members, Chairperson Drews.
Here.
Vice Chair Darney. Commissioner Block.
Here.
Commissioner Hayes.
Here.
Commissioner Schmitter.
Here.
Commissioner Smith.
Here.
Commissioner Svelda.
Here.
O'Quorum's present.
Thank you. This time I'd like to open up the meeting for any public comment. Looks like a big no out there for that. So we'll move right ahead to meeting items. Agenda item 3A, presentation and discussion, presentation by Aaron West, CEO of Nevada Builders Alliance, regarding reconstruction plans for Jack's Bar. So come on up, Aaron.
Right on. Thank you. Thank you for having me. For the record, Aaron West, CEO of the Nevada Builders Alliance. I don't know if there's any way to dim any of the lights to see, maybe see the I'll tell you, it's not much of a presentation, but just wanted to kind of give you some pictures, visual indication of kind of where things are at. Okay. Cool. So, thankfully, I don't have to tell you guys much about the building, right? It's fairly iconic, Carson City structure. A little history, you know, part of what kind of really excited us about getting involved. The fact that the building, it was built in 1899 and opened as the Bank Saloon. And so we are starting to transition folks into thinking of it as the Bank Saloon. We intend to rebrand it, going back to the Bank Saloon. I think that's fairly iconic. It's kind of interesting looking at the timeline. It literally it operated for about 90 years, and then it's been closed for 30 years. It's hard to believe that it's been closed that long. But here we go. We're excited about the project. I will tell you that because of the tricky nature of it, we wouldn't even be undertaking this if it wasn't for some very key members of our group, you know, particularly Bill Miles with Miles Construction, his experience with historic buildings, and him giving us the confidence that this one wasn't going to fall over in the process, has kind of inspired us to move forward. So, so this is kind of, you know, started off with a picture of kind of what everybody pictures as Jack's Bar, right? Going from the 80s, early 80s. So if you've been by there recently, you've noticed that we did pull the exterior signage off. We want to start that rebranding process, and so we want people to start thinking about it. The other thing to notice in this is, and this is where it's been a challenge for us getting into it, is the storefront that's there now. We're not even sure when that storefront came into being, but it certainly wasn't the original storefront. It was done in 1899. The building has gone through several iterations, and at one point in the, it appears that in the 60s, they had the ill-fated idea to come in and put vinyl flooring throughout the entire building. And then also, there must have been some roof repairs done at that time, and product was used, and the reason I bring that up is that, unfortunately, all of that vinyl flooring and the roofing material that was used during that time frame had asbestos in it. So if you've seen activity over there in the last week or so, we are going through an asbestos remediation process. And unfortunately, it's, you know, by the time that's done, and because of just the degradation of the interior, we're not going to have a lot to work with. So as we kind of talk about the history, right, it's pretty funny. And I really want to give some folks credit here. I mean, Michelle Schmitter, Jed Block, and Michael, appreciate your guys' energy and effort. You know, when we first got this thing into escrow, we started digging around, seeing what we could find, and it was staggering how few photos existed. We went through the Historical Society, through the museum. Literally, the Nevada Museum had one picture, and it was from the back corner looking towards Carson Street. So I really want to thank you know, folks in your group here that have really stepped forward. And you know, I'm not sure where they're digging these things up, but I love it. So, you know, we're trying to use it to the extent possible. You know, the one on the left is a great picture, if it wasn't for the car blocking the view. But but it does give you an idea of the time period, right? And then the one on the right is actually that is the oldest photo that I think that we found to date, right? And Michelle, you tracked this one down. Oh, yeah, you can't really see it, right, because it's old, yeah. And so the Bucaneri family, is that? Yeah, Virgil Bucaneri. So apparently that's him as a child. And so but one of the things that it's interesting in some of the descriptions of the building, you see they talked about these huge window storefront that this thing had that let in a tremendous amount of light. And so... in fact, one reference I saw was that's why they redid the front at some point, because they were tired of cleaning all the glass. So it's kind of as we start working through this process, you know, our intent is to reestablish this as an iconic building in downtown Carson City, and but I think it's going to have to take on a little bit of a life of its own in this next iteration. We don't have enough information to be able to go back and say, you know, put it back to, 1899 period perfect condition. And I'll tell you a little bit about that, why on some of that. But also, you know, we want this thing to be very functional and, you know, really become an attraction for downtown Carson for the next 100 years, right? So so I think, Jed, you found this picture for us. You know, we were just trying to get an idea of a bar and you know, in that time frame, what would that look like? And interestingly enough, or maybe was it you, Michelle? Because we made note of the wallpaper. It's hard to see in the picture, but along the top, there's a border basically right up against the ceiling of wallpaper. And we actually found similar material in the bar. So, you know, very similar, all plaster walls and ceiling. So interestingly enough, we were told that this was a picture of a back bar that was in there at one time. I think we've since debunked that. Oh, it was, but it wasn't original. Okay, that's right. It was moved from the Capitol or something. So this was there. So we had an idea that it wasn't the original back bars. It's actually very ornate. And so was this the one that was sold in the auction when they shut it down? Okay. But you can see it's one of those we're trying to get our head around, you know, if this is period correct and this is what it ended up at, where do we land, right? So at the end of the day, I can guarantee we will do something tasteful. We will do something, you know, that will be an attraction. And the reason I say that is that then we get to the condition. And a lot of folks, you know, the idea of trying to do a historic restoration of this, when you see the level of deterioration within the building, you realize that, unfortunately, it literally has to be gutted. So the picture on the left, that the light that you see on the towards the upper part of that picture, that's actually the exterior outside. That's the sun coming through the roof. That's in the main room of Jack's Bar there, and you can't really see it in the picture, but there's a beam that actually breaks up the space, splits the space, and the beam, there's about 8 inches of deflection in that beam as it goes across that room, and unfortunately that was one of the primary support structures for the roof. So the whole thing is coming down, and you can see that all the boards, you see the boards running towards us. So the entire roof, the ceiling sheeting, and then the plaster that went over that, that's all down. The one on the right, it was just an example. You guys may have heard we had a nice little pigeon colony in the property for numerous years, and so in some cases we found close to 12 inches of pigeon droppings. So it's been quite the adventure. We relocated about 130 pigeons out of the building. And after we get done with the asbestos abatement, you know, and the rest of the cleanup, unfortunately, with all of that, the water damage to the floor is such that we have, you know, 90% of the floor is rotted out. The walls that were sitting on that supported floor are now collapsing into. And so that starts to, and here's some more fun pictures. let's just say it was in really bad shape. So moving forward, we've got some challenges ahead of us. From a structural perspective, we literally have to go in and remove everything from inside the rock walls. At the end of the day, the intent is to really save those. So we have to remove everything and then actually do a structural slab with foundation inside the existing rock walls. And then from there, actually do walls inside the rock walls that'll be connected to the rock and support the structure going forward. And so, one, in terms of trying to preserve, you know, the floor plan for historic purposes or whatever, it's not practical because we have to remove everything out anyway. And then the other part, it's not practical from just a use perspective going forward. So as you see it evolve, literally everything but the rock walls will be removed. You'll see a slab go in. You'll see structural walls come up inside. And then we'll resheet those new roof. And we're still kicking around some ideas. There was talk of, could we possibly incorporate a rooftop deck? We're still playing with whether or not that's feasible and would it take away from the character of the building. But it would be a pretty cool spot to watch the Nevada Day Parade, right? So we're trying to balance all those things out. So this is kind of a working floor plan that we have right now. I think there's probably still some adjustments to be made, and I don't know if you guys can, if it makes much sense. But basically what we tried to do is keep the existing layout where essentially half of the building, the front half of the building was the bar saloon. And then now, of course, codes have changed, right? So the two little bathrooms that were in there don't work by today's standards. So since we have to rebuild this, we have to go in with two handicapped accessible restrooms. We're trying to make the bar area as functional as possible, so we need to look at either incorporating some storage or even a walk-in cooler. And just in terms of trying to really maximize the usable space as an attraction for downtown, what we're looking at is the bar area and then doing a large conference room, consolidating some of the rooms that were in the back and making a large conference room so we can have, you know, many sorts of events in the space, and even be able to open up the wall between the conference room and the bar so that we can have some fun with that. But the conference room should be able to seat about 20 people. The small room in the upper left, that would be my office when we're all said and done. I was hoping for more space, but all these constraints keep getting in there. So that will still be the headquarters of the Nevada Builders Alliance. But we really are trying to make the space such that it becomes a community attraction and, you know, has a lot of use. That's kind of where we're at. So, yeah, again, if we can try and, to some degree, you know, if we can preserve the exterior by doing a lot on the interior and really then kind of get it back to being that downtown attraction, we've got a lot of other little ideas, but that's kind of where we're at now. We're still working through the process. I actually have a meeting with the architect and builder tomorrow, and so that we can try to start to nail some of this stuff down. But with any luck, we'll have plans put together and be submitting for permit about the first of the year, if all goes well. Let's say if all goes well. Happy to take any questions.
Thanks, sir.
So what will I see in the exterior looking at the east side that used to have a lot more glass? Are we going to have more glass than what's there now, or what?
So the east face, yeah. So basically the storefront, right? The storefront that's along Carson Street. Yeah, I think, well, right now there's no glass, right? So, that's what we're playing with right now. And Michelle actually brought up some pretty cool examples that are probably a little more comparable that are up in Virginia City. So we're now doing some research up there, similar type construction, storefronts that kind of play off. But there's also talk of, you know, we're really trying to look for how do we create an iconic space for downtown Carson that becomes, you know, an attraction. And is it worth, you know, we have some advantages there because of the orientation, where you could even open up those walls and actually have an indoor-outdoor space. It really could. It could be kind of fun. But those are just thoughts. I wouldn't say that we've overly committed one way or the other on that. It's just tough to go back to 1899 and try to recreate that facade and then realize that the rest of the the rest of the interior of the building is going to have to make, you know, some upgrade. You know, it's going to be certainly more modern in certain areas. It's unfortunate, right? But the way that the codes have changed, you know, now you have to with the surfaces that you have to maintain and the things that you have to do in order to get through, you know, the health department, the building code standards, there's going to be things that are going to be very different. But I will guarantee you, it's an upgrade over what was left there, with the wood paneling on the walls and the you know, just multiple layers and a pretty degraded floor.
So Aaron, you're still going to put your opening where the existing opening is, the historic opening, because you have the cast iron.
Right.
So there's. It's not like you can do anything too crazy.
Yeah, great point. Yeah, the intent is fully to maintain the cast iron columns. And, in fact, we're having to do some other structural upgrades within the building. We have to do actually a steel moment frame to secure the front. And then we also have to incorporate a CMU block wall into the building for sheer value, but so that we can preserve those cast iron columns, because you might notice that there's a little bit of a shift to them, and we think it's probably more hazardous to try and play with moving those back into alignment than just to stabilize them in place and build from there.
Aaron, could you go back to the slide that shows the bar, not the bar back? That one right there?
Yeah.
Take a good close look next time you go into the Battleborn Social. It's got the rounded elements, and the bar that's in the social was up in Virginia City, I think in the Union for about 30 years in the back room, pushed up against the wall. And there is another picture floating around of the Union somewhere that was at the poorhouse, but that bar might be in Carson.
Oh, interesting.
And then when you talk about the metal columns, when they did the renovation at 310 North Carson Street, they exposed the old metal columns. That was the location of the Globe, which had the first lit sign in Carson that closed in December 1918 before Prohibition, but it reopened up as the Old Globe. And it was Virgil Buccaneri's brother, I think it was Austin or Autumn Buccaneri, that had that. But those are exposed now as well.
Yeah, they're pretty iconic, and the fact that they're cast iron, they're pretty cool. It actually has the foundry reference on them.
Aaron,
hi.
Just real quick, on the south elevation where the stone's intact and the fenestration's intact, the idea is to preserve that facade, correct?
Yes. Yeah, the south-facing wall. Yeah. Well, and I should point out that so not only do we need to stabilize it structurally from the inside, but there is a fair amount of stonework to do as well in repointing and trying to preserve some of the stuff that's there. We've had some pretty good-sized chunks that have broken off over time, and we were surprised to find some of them actually on the roof. So we're trying to figure out how to put some of that back and see what we can do to restore it. But, yeah, we really want to preserve that stonework.
Well, we're really excited that you've taken this project on, and we wish you good luck on the progress. So anything we can do to help, we'll be glad to.
I appreciate that.
Any further discussion? Public comment?
Sorry.
Yeah. I'm like, Dan, you coming at me? What? Right on.
Okay. Well, with that, thank you, Aaron, very much for your presentation and enlightening us. Moving on to agenda item 3B, presentation and discussion to give an update on solicit public comments on the 30% design at South Carson Street. So, Dan, I guess you're up for this one.
Yeah, while you're getting that set up, I'll go ahead and give a little introduction. Lee Plummel, Community Development Director. And so keeping in line with these presentations tonight, I hope these are informative. You know, we had these things where we had some groups that wanted to present to both groups eventually. There's some crossover and things like this. We have this that goes in like this project where Dan was looking to get some feedback from the Historic Commission regarding the 106 review. Did I get the number right? Sorry. Stuff blanking off the top of my head. But it's also in the redevelopment district, important project that, you know, that the Citizens Committee is considering and doing other applications and along with these other things on the agenda. So hopefully tonight with this joint meeting, you hope come away and get some good information. And thanks for coming to this special meeting to all of you and getting together so that we can combine this and get this information out to you all at once instead of splitting it up and going to different meetings. Yeah, so Dan's going to give us an update. He's been to the, who was the last? No,
RTC.
RTC, yeah.
Great.
RTC's been the only presentation so far on this level, and he'll be going to the Planning Commission later this month with the presentation. He's been to the Citizens Committee in the past early on, and so there, finally up.
All right. Thanks. Sorry for the delay on that, everyone. Dan Stuckey, City Engineer, for the record. I'm joined by Tom Grundy. He's our Senior Project Manager with the city, and he's the Project Manager for the South Carson Project. So, yeah, as Lee mentioned, just like we've done on the downtown Carson and Curry projects, the RAC is a board that we go to seek comment along with RTC, and obviously then we go on to the Board of Supervisors for approval at each design milestone. So today is a great opportunity because I didn't even realize HRC was going to be here until a couple weeks ago, but it's a great opportunity. We can talk about, like Lee said, NEPA and specifically this Section 106 of NEPA. So we'll talk a little bit about that today. But I wanted to give RAC really just a project overview. I'll try to run through it pretty quick of just where we're at with everything. We'll talk about some of the project features. We'll also talk about funding and schedule moving forward with the project, and then I'll end it with, I wanted to make sure, obviously for people that are watching maybe on TV, but also all for you all, just some various tools that we have available to keep connected during project design and construction for the public. So we'll go through all that today. So just a little background, and most of you probably know this even better than I do, but just kind of how we came to this point today. So in 2014, you know, the board approved the plan of expenditures for those facility and corridor projects that are funded with that infrastructure tax funding. And that included in that plan the South Carson Street corridor. So this has been planned out for a long time. You all know with those projects, we've done the MAC, animal shelter, Curry and Carson projects downtown. Theater improvements over at Bob Boldrick are coming here. That'll be constructed in really like in a couple weeks. It'll start improvements there. So those are all associated with these projects. So this is kind of the next step in line. A little background, in 2016, we did a corridor study for the South Carson Street project, and this involved coming up kind of with a conceptual plan of how that those improvements would look through the corridor, but it also included some public outreach. There's two public meetings. I'll talk a little bit about those. And based off the feedback that we received from the public meeting where the businesses and the interested residents got a vote on certain features, we've tried to incorporate those as best we can. So that's really, those public meetings are really the basis for this design. In April 2018, there was big news. Hopefully a lot of you have heard, but we won a $7.6 million approximately Tiger grant, which is a major, highly competitive federal grant. And these are only for projects, I think, between 5 and 25 million. So they have to be a good size, or the grants are only between 5 and 25 million. So they're big grants. So this is a huge win for us and really allows us to do the project from Fifth Street all the way down to about Appian Way. So that was a big win. When we received that news, we kind of stopped the project. We were moving forward with that, but we wanted to make sure we were communicating with the federal, the Tiger representatives, and making sure we understood all the grants. So now we're clear to go and move forward with that. July and August, we assembled the design team and really started really moving forward with the design. And then October, November there, we did some public outreach to the businesses along the corridor, which I'll talk about. We completed the 30% design, and like Lee mentioned, we went and presented to RTC and for approval, and then we're planning on going to the Board of Supervisors the December 18th or 20th, whatever, the second one in December, so the next board meeting, we'll go and present that to them. So just a little project overview. So like I mentioned, Fifth Street all the way down to about Appian Way is where the project improvements are. And I just put a couple bullets, just wanted to run through what those improvements will be. The project, it fits that complete streets theme that we've tried to incorporate in some of the downtown projects where you're really, it's not just, you know, it's turning this corridor from less of just a state highway where people are trying to move through as fast as they can to more of a street that's appropriate for the corridor that's down there. This is one of the Carson City's most valuable commercial corridors, lots of business that happens there. So trying to provide a street that can accommodate business access as well as, you know, provide a good route for motorists, but also pedestrians and cyclists. So we'll talk about some of those features that will provide that kind of complete streets, a street for everyone. There's significant storm drainage improvements, about $303 million worth of underground storm drain. And a lot of that is to get some of that runoff that happens in smaller events where, you know, it causes some flooding along that corridor, try to get some of that flow underground and push it through to the east. Landscaping improvements, so similar to what was on downtown, maybe not quite at that level, it'll be different, but we'll be doing some nice landscaping along the corridor, native low-maintenance type landscaping features. So that'll be included with this project. There'll be a multi-use path, which I know is a big highlight for a lot of people. It'll be a 12-foot multi-use path, and it'll run along the east side of the street there. And there's already a multi-use path down at the very south, which is from the Nevada Department of Transportation. So we'll extend that, and that's on the west side of the street. And then at some point, we cross over to the east side of the street and keep running that north. We talked about business access being a real big feature of this project, and that's something that the businesses had a lot of input when we did those outreach meetings in 2016 and 2017. There's a lot, as you know, there's a lot of that raised center median along much of the corridor, which makes it difficult, you know, if you're on one side of the street and you want to get to the other, a business on the other side of the street, it makes it difficult to kind of maneuver along the corridor. So part of this project, we're removing a lot of that raised median, and we're providing a dual center turn lane for much of the corridor. So that was a big sell for the businesses because it really will increase business access along that corridor. The street lighting, we'll have some decorative street lighting, particularly north of Stewart Street. We'll have either we're looking at options, but either similar to downtown or possibly some of those decorative street lighting that you see on Fairview Drive there, we might implement into this project as well. I put the frontage road. For the most part, the frontage road will remain as is. In instances where we could either connect and make it easier to kind of maneuver through, we did, or if there was entrances, exits that we wanted to eliminate just to make it flow better, we incorporated that in design. So there are some minor modifications, but for the most part, it'll be left alone. A roundabout location. This is something there was about, during the corridor study, there was about six or seven locations along the corridor where a roundabout was proposed. We've had further analysis on that, and we're proposing a designing a roundabout at Stewart and Carson Street. That was really the area where there was the best benefit, cost benefit for the roundabout. And I have a slide just on that that we'll talk about. We have some illuminated pedestrian crossings planned for the corridor, and this is something we'll probably be seeking some public input on as far as where those are actually going to be located. But part of this is improving pedestrian walkability and access to the businesses for pedestrians. So we'll have some crossings that are, you know, the push button type crossings, really safe to get across there. And then the last thing, beyond just the storm drainage improvements, there are a lot of other utility improvements, water, sewer. We're also doing some fiber optic line, critical fiber optic line along the corridor there. So lots going on with this project. It's a pretty, pretty big one. These are the street cross sections, and I'll go through these that were voted on at those public meetings. And I'll just go over kind of what this is going to look like throughout the corridor. So if you start at the Snyder, so this is very south end all the way to about Stewart. What you'll have is two northbound, two southbound in that center turn lane, so five total lanes that will run through during that stretch. You'll have a bike path on the west side of the street. You'll have a landscape buffer, which you can see up there on the east side. That'll kind of provide a safety net kind of for those people that are using the multi-use path to separate it from the roadway. And then just east of that the landscape buffer, you'll have that 12-foot multi-use path. So that's the typical cross section there. And then the next second section down, that's essentially that same cross section, except we added in the frontage road. So you can see the frontage road's basically just added to that. And then the last cross section, this one has actually changed slightly since those public outreach meetings. We did further traffic analysis, and we determined that we needed two southbound travel lanes. So instead of those landscape buffers there, now we're going to have an extra lane. So you'll still have bike paths on both sides, but there won't be there's not enough room for those landscape buffers. So that did change slightly from kind of where we were in the conceptual stage. So just wanted to point that out. As I mentioned, in October, city staff and some of the other design team members walked the entire corridor, met with approximately 250 businesses over a two-week period in October. During that time, we discussed, kind of like what I'm talking to you guys about today, is we discussed some of the project features. We also gave a rough timeline. We're still a ways away from construction, but we wanted to start those conversations and, you know, talk about a little bit about the construction timeline and also future public meetings where they can provide feedback. We also talked about, sorry, I lost my train of thought. Oh, the communication tools, which I'll talk about today. So some of the ways people can connect, stay connected through design and construction. Majority of businesses were extremely positive about the project. A lot of them liked what was done downtown. Now, this is going to be a very different project from what's been done downtown. It's just a different type of corridor. But they really liked, you know, the beautification that was done and those street improvements, and we're excited to have that down south. I did put a couple comments these were some comments that we did feel that I like to talk about. So obviously people impacts during construction, how that's going to impact their business. One of the things we're doing with this project, which we did on downtown, a lot of our other projects, is we have a construction manager at risk. So we essentially have the contractor that will eventually construct this project. We have them providing input during the design stage. And this is a big advantage, I believe, and makes a better project in the end, because we can start talking about construction phasing, and they can provide their input as we move through, and then we can provide the businesses along that corridor how things are going to look before construction happens, rather than just, you know, a typical low bid project where it goes out and you don't know which contractor you're going to get. They know nothing about the project. They just bid on it, and then they have to get up to speed. So I think the way we're going to do this, I'm hoping we minimize construction as best we can along that corridor. One thing that was brought up on a couple occasions was concerns from businesses that, you know, that landscaping buffer area, if we put up landscaping, tall, you know, big growth types of features there, landscaping, that it would block their business signage. So this is something that was already on our radar before, And what we're working with the design landscape architect, to make sure that if we do have more high vegetation type things, we're going to kind of strategically group those together to avoid impacts to signage and businesses. And then in other areas, we're going to have more low-lying landscape. So that's definitely being taken into account during design. I mentioned on the pedestrian crossings, there was some talk about, you know, I wish we had more pedestrian crossing areas and better ways to get across the corridor. So that's being implemented with this project. I mentioned the existing raised center medians. That was another concern. They wanted to make sure that we were still going with that center turn lane as they voted on, and we are. I actually did a rough count of the amount of raised median that's between Colorado and Coons. Or Clearview, I think, in Coons or in Colorado. There was a 4,000 linear feet that we're basically going to be eliminating of that raised center median, so pretty substantial along there. So that was a big highlight. There was a couple businesses that were, especially like the car dealerships and some of the auto repair, auto service type businesses down there that were happy that we moved the roundabout to the north part, because with all, you can imagine those cars, dealerships, they have these big truckloads that are come in probably every couple of days to deliver vehicles. And so they were concerned how those trucks were going to maneuver the roundabout. So they were happy that it was moved north. I do want to mention, though, that the roundabout that we will have in the north can handle, the city just recently is purchasing a big fire truck, so we're making sure that it can accommodate that and other very big trucks, so that shouldn't be an issue, but they were still happy about that. And then the last thing, you know, people, it was kind of a mixed. Some people mentioned that, oh, we've noticed a huge, since the freeway opened, huge reduction in traffic, and then some were a little hesitant still about, you know, we know you're going to reduce some lanes here. I'm not sure, has there been that much of a traffic reduction? So that's one thing we discussed with them, and I'll talk about it here on this slide. So we've, you know, have traffic counts set up before the freeway, those different phases of those freeway extensions, and obviously looking at post-traffic data. This project was based on modeling, you know, looking at not only what was happening before, but also projecting that out, traffic modeling for like a 2040 certain build-out scenario. But you can see, and basically all the projections that we were modeling years ago have basically played out since those legs of the freeway have opened. So you can see the first graph, you can see that huge dip that I've highlighted in red there. That's a 40% reduction. That's south of Fairview. So that station there is at Coons Lane. And so there's been a 40% reduction since the opening of that phase 2B of the I-580 in late 2017. And actually, I think even numbers since have shown it even go down to about 45% reduction. So significant reduction there. I think the model planned on a 40% reduction. And then 5th to Stewart. So this is the section, you know, obviously north of Fairview. There was basically two different reductions with each leg of the freeway. So after the phase 2A of I-580 opened in 2009, there was that first kind of reduction you see. That was about a 33%. And then since the last leg of that freeway opened, there has been another 30% reduction. So there has been a significant, almost half the traffic really in a lot of these areas than what was there before the freeway. So again, this, we want to make this project something that's more appropriate for how the roadway is being used today, not what it was used as, you know, 5-10 years ago. And again, I mentioned we are constantly traffic demand modeling, looking at existing condition, but also making sure that what we implement here is going to work well in the build-out scenario. I know there's been some backup from really at the very south part of the project, so our project's not really touching stuff south of Appian Way, but I know at that interchange down there, there is backup there. One thing that we're currently doing is looking at signal timing through that corridor and making sure we can optimize signal timing to a way that we can officially move traffic as well as we can through that area. So I did want to point that out. Here's the roundabout. I'm not going to go into a lot of like the nerdy like engineering details, but I wanted to give you guys a good feel for this. So one of the ways we evaluate, because I think people get excited about roundabouts. Some people really love them. Some people are a little hesitant. We at the city, and I know there's a lot of others out there, that a well-designed roundabout can function really well and move traffic really efficiently. And not only that, they're really safe. And that's a big thing for us. So how is this roundabout going to function? We've modeled this. We have a design consultant working on the design of roundabout for us. But essentially, it's going to operate. What we do is level of service is how we analyze intersections. And so a level of service A is basically like a free-flowing intersection, very little delay time through the intersection. So in the 2040, if you take in the PM peak hour modeling traffic and put it out into a build-out scenario in 2040, this roundabout's still going to function at a very high level, basically better or matching what it is today with the existing signal there. Another thing about a roundabout is you, with a traffic signal, I think a lot of people don't realize that there's a lot of operation and maintenance costs associated with that. Roundabout, there's very little maintenance costs. Once you have it in, I mean, it flows the same way now as it's going to. There's no adjustments in signal timing. There's no maintenance to traffic signals. So that's a big appeal to it. I did want to point out one of the big selling points of our Tiger grant was the roundabout. The FHWA is very into roundabouts and what they can do from a safety standpoint. I saw a statistic, it's a basically 90% reduction in fatalities, traffic-related fatalities, a roundabout versus a regular intersection. There's about a 75% reduction in traffic collisions from a roundabout to a signalized intersection. So big safety components there. We actually, there's a methodology that the federal FHWA uses that our consultant put together, and we project about a 50% reductions in crashes once we install this roundabout. And when you put over cost savings, and this is societal cost savings, so it's difficult to quantify, but this is basically considering, like, you know, property damage, vehicle damage, medical type bills that are when a traffic accident happens, or even fatalities, and kind of trying to quantify that. And we expect about a $3 million savings over about a 20-year period. So significant safety improvements from this roundabout. One thing we did incorporate in the design as of now is it's a single lane roundabout, so it's much easier to navigate. Once, if you have multi-lanes going into a roundabout, it gets a little tricky when you want to maneuver. I think most of us have experienced a multi-lane versus a single lane. So right now we're proposing as a single lane roundabout, which I think will be very easy to navigate, which is a plus. And then the other big feature is that it's aesthetically a roundabout can offer some appealing qualities. I mean, it's a great spot for landscaping. We thought of this as a great area to transition from more of a little higher speed commercial corridor south of Stewart and transitioning into more of a downtown feel north of Stewart. So we thought this could kind of serve as that gateway to downtown, gateway feature type of improvement. So that's another positive quality of the roundabout. So that leads us into the South Carson Gateway feature. And we were at RAC probably been 4 or 5 months ago talking about gateway feature, gateway signage. And one of the directions you guys gave us back then was, you know, to look into it a little further, come up with some kind of conceptual ideas, costs, look at costs, and come up with something that, you know, is something we want. And the Board of Supervisors had the same recommendation. So what we did is we formed a working group, and this working group consisted of city staff, so planning, public works, others, our director of art at the city, the mayor, Supervisor Barrett, so he was representing the supervisors, but also RAC, artists, business owners, and other community leaders. We brought them together for about a two-hour meeting and discussed. We worked with our design consultant, and they presented various options of what we could do. And then we had a nice discussion. I thought it was really productive. I'll talk a little bit. I'll show you some pictures of what we discussed. But one of the things we determined was location, and everybody was in agreement that the roundabout location would be a great place to put this gateway feature. Then we talked about type and cost, and I'll go through. We basically broke that out into three categories. One was a text-based sign, which looks like this. So this is the cheaper of the option. The cheapest option, excuse me. And the discussion, people wanted something a little more, but they also were worried about a bunch of text in a roundabout. People, you know, have to navigate a roundabout safely, and we didn't really want people to have to read a sign. So this was eliminated pretty quickly and early on in the discussion. The next option, number two, was arches. And so this is the most expensive of the alternatives, and there's some examples. You can see some of them are pretty significant. And there's a really interesting discussion, and there were some great concepts that were presented beyond what's shown on the screen, and really just I learned a lot from the discussion. It was interesting hearing the artist input on it. But one was cost. I think we were a little hesitant to spend a, you know, I mean, you're talking $300,000, $500,000 on something like this, $1 million possibly, depending on what you do. So very high cost. And people also, this was interesting, is they thought of an arch as kind of a dividing type structure. There's an entrance on one side, an entrance on the other, and it's kind of a dividing type of feature. And they wanted something, you know, inclusive. And when you look at the roundabout, you have traffic coming in from the north, south, east. And so something that could be put there that would provide like a visual for all those people entering the roundabout. So something that is more of like a 360-degree view. So after that discussion, we kind of moved on to the last category, which is like a sculptural, structural type element. And I'll show a couple examples of those. And I don't want anybody to get too excited because, I mean, some of these things, I think there's like a dragonfly. I mean, we're not going to put a dragonfly up there. But this does give you a feel for some of the options, some pretty cool things. And this was cost-wise, it was somewhere in between the text-based sign and the arch, you know. So really, people, the preferred option I show there on the preference, and this is kind of our, I guess, mission statement or whatever that came out of the working group there, is the gateway feature in the roundabout should be a structural / sculptural element which incorporates local culture and clean, simple lines. So that's how we came out of that meeting. I think it's really good direction. I think we'd like to move forward with that. The next steps, what I'm envisioning, is we would go ahead and design something and basically bring it back here to you all, and we can talk about, you know, possibly getting some funding for construction of that feature. So if you guys are in acceptance with that, I think that's the way we would go. I can come back. We can talk about it too at the end if you want, but yeah. I'll move on. So as I mentioned before, because this is a now, with the Tiger Grants, a federalized project, so we have to meet the requirements, the guidelines of the Nevada or National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA. So there's kind of two major components. I know we have the SHPO people here, so they understand this better than I do. But from an environmental side, what we're pursuing with this project is it's called a categorical exclusion. So it's essentially a less extensive environmental review kind of the project. And basically the reason why is, for the most part, this project, there's already a roadway there. We're just kind of beautifying that roadway. We are doing some upgrading some utilities along the corridor, but we're staying within the existing roadway limits. So we're not disturbing new land, I guess is what you could say. The second part of that is the Section 106, which is kind of looking at how this project could impact historical or cultural resources. And so we were fortunate to meet with SHPO. We had a nice pre-consultation meeting. I was not in attendance, but Tom was. We appreciate them for kind of helping us kind of work through and come up with a game plan moving forward with how to properly go through that Section 106. So as part of that Section 106, you know, we'll consult with the Native American tribes, the public, local entities, other nonprofits, and then the HRC is seeking input from you all on any historic preservation concerns or cultural resource type concerns. So I know we have plan on coming back on January 7th for the HRC meeting to formally do this, but I think it's always good to take an opportunity in this and you know, open up to any comments that you guys might have off the top of your head in regards to any historical or cultural resources along that corridor, and then also give the public an opportunity. So I don't know the correct process to do this, if we just open it up now, Lee, or?
I mean, I think informally, if you're having it on then, I think you can take comments to have the Historic Resource Commissioner start thinking about it. If you have any input now, go ahead. But you know, and they'll come back, you can think about it too and come back.
I can keep going.
The one main thing right there is that's where the V&T came back into the lumber yards and stuff along there. And when we did, downtown Carson, we looked at some of the old V&T maps and found structural features that may be buried under that corridor. Okay. So that's something we should probably be cognizant of as we go through the 106 process to make sure we have that.
Okay. appreciate that. We can, did you have one, Michelle?
Well, just tagging off of that, we might also want to consider the sculptural element to have some sort of historical connection to what's, where it's at.
Absolutely, and that was the discussion that we brought up in that meeting as well, as that was one of the, and kind of within our mission statement, is having some sort of cultural element, historic element in that sculpture that tied into that area. So that is something we would look at. If you guys come up, I'll just keep going with the presentation, then I'll open it up to comments at the end too, and you can provide input there as well. So here's just a recap of the project funding. Roughly $19 million in funds, redevelopment. There's $205,000 right now from redevelopment. And then you look at about $1 million from infrastructure. The Tiger, which I mentioned, was about $7.6 million. The state, we actually, for taking over that right-of-way, that corridor, they gave us money per an agreement with them as well. So you see that there. Stormwater, roughly $3 million, and then the water and sewer improvements as well. So that sums up to be that roughly $19 million. And then if you just look at the project cost breakdown, that kind of shows you how much between design and construction. Real quick schedule. So design milestones. So as I mentioned, we completed the 30 January, February timeframe is when we're going to be at the 60% design, and then April, May, 90, and then finishing up around June and July. We do have some public meetings and workshops planned next Tuesday, December 11th, over at the Sheriff's Complex, the Ormsby Room. We will have a public meeting. We've sent out, either they're going out soon, letters to the businesses. They've been mailed. We're also trying to push out on social media and all sorts of other things. So if you all know people in that corridor, please help spread the word as well on that. So that'll be a very similar to meeting, kind of what I'm having here, except we'll probably have some conceptual plans around the room so people can walk around and provide input. So that's coming up here soon. And then we're also probably planning a January, February type workshop that might be sitting down with the individual businesses and talking more specific design to their business, but also maybe talking a little more construction at that point and how phasing is going to work if we have that information then. So those are some public meetings we have planned. And then, just like I mentioned at the beginning, with the board and committees, we're going to be coming back to you all at 60 and 90, just like we did with Curry and Carson. And we'll also be doing that with RTC and the board. And then the plan is to start construction by the end of 2019. So probably late fall, they might start doing some utility work. But the bulk of construction will happen during that 2020 year.
I have a question for you. Yeah. Part on the east side of the South Corridor, there are some properties, some vacant, some businesses that now are not on sewer. Will you be filling all that in then?
It depends. We have spoken with one of the property owners down there. If we can fit it in within our budget and it makes sense, I mean, I think we have to be careful with budget and all that. But, yeah, I mean, it's something we're looking at in design if we can make that happen.
Yeah, because there's a vacant property there, and then beside it, I think it's the mill house or whatever that mm-hmm. is not on sewer as well.
Yeah. So it's something we've had those discussions, and the design team is aware, and we'll see how we can make that work. So it's in our sights for sure. Project communication tools. So this is there's a bunch of different ways to stay connected. CarsonProud.com is one, and I think most of you have hopefully been to that website. If you haven't, check it out. I'm going to actually be doing some updates to it here in this week. We'll be pushing out more information, but it's a great resource to get updates on these corridor projects as well as other interesting projects around the city. We also put out a text subscription service this year. So if you guys are into texting, or the public's out there into texting, it's really easy. You text Carson Proud to the number 31996. And what this will do is any updates, like, for example, the public meeting we're having next week, I just received, because I'm subscribed, I just received a text on my phone saying, hey, there's a public meeting December 11th at the Ormsby Room. So it's not going to bombard you with a bunch of texts. You know, we're very sensitive to that. But for key stuff, and as we get closer to construction, it'll probably pick up even more. So that's a great avenue to stay connected. Social media, we're pushing out stuff there. We'll also, when we get into construction, and we're still about a year away, but we'll have our live construction map, and then we'll also set up a construction hotline as well. That concludes my presentation, so I'd be happy to open it up for questions.
Thanks, Dan. I have one comment and a question, too. I think that the idea of a sculpture is a great one. Wondering if there's, when you're going to bring it back to us, you're going to bring one possibility only, or are you going to?
I mean, I think we were kind of hoping to narrow in on one, just because, I mean, we kind of worked out what we want with the working group, and then I think we'd get an artist or a designer on board to kind of modify that a little bit. But if you have another plan, I mean, we'd be happy to hear it.
No, I think that's I mean, we can modify from what we see going from there, too.
Yeah, I think, yeah, exactly.
Okay. Second, just a question. So right now we have two lanes going southbound from 5th Street to Stewart, where the roundabout's proposed, and then three lanes going southbound from Stewart to on. And so you said the roundabout's one, so am I correct in my thought that you're going to go two lanes into the roundabout, but then one as you enter the roundabout, because you said a single lane roundabout, and then back out of the roundabout going south on Carson Street back into two lanes? So basically two, then into one at the roundabout, and then back to two?
Yeah, so this, I think, it's really hard probably to see there, and this is very conceptual at this point, but essentially there's two lanes coming southbound into the roundabout. Well, there's two southbound lanes north of the roundabout, but there's two southbound lanes south of the roundabout, too. There, one doesn't drop off. But what this roundabout does is it has a bypass lane on the very west side. So I don't know if you can see there. The lane on the very west just bypasses that roundabout and never goes through. And then one lane heads in, basically. Does that make – yeah, sorry. I should have pointed that out. I apologize for that.
No, that's great. Thank you. That clears it up completely for me. Thank you.
I have a question for you, Dan. Speaking on the east side, is it going to be continuous water service for fire protection and everything, which we know that there's some breaks in it for that? Is that going to be fixed as well?
Yeah, I know, Tom, you could probably better answer this question than I. I know we are looking at improvements to our water system to kind of better utilize that, those zones and the connection, right, Tom?
Tom Grundy with Public Works. I think the gap in the water service you're talking about is in front of the mill house and then the vacant lot to the south. And, I mean, budget permitting, we'd like to fill in that gap in the water main. I don't know that we'll have budget to do that or not. And we're not doing anything on the frontage road that would prevent a future installation of that water main. We're not going to resurface the frontage road, so it wouldn't be like we're cutting new asphalt whenever that water line does go in there. The only places that really don't have fire service right now are vacant lots.
And that's a good point, I think, back to Ronnie's comment is, with those sewer extension and water extension to those vacant properties, like Tom mentioned, the frontage road is essentially, we're not resurfacing. It's basically staying the way it is. So if we were going to go and do a whole new frontage road, we would definitely put in those utilities when we did that, because we wouldn't want to come back, like Tom mentioned, you know, 5 years later and cut in to our new road, right? But since we're not touching that area, it's not as big of a, it's kind of like almost outside of our project limits to go in there. So that's kind of what we're weighing with that, to kind of go back to your original question there.
Dan, is FHWA the lead on the NEPA?
We will work with FHWA on the NEPA. There's NDOT's not involved with this project. Typically, NDOT kind of acts as a buffer between the city and FHWA, but in this case, Carson City is the recipient of the Tiger Grant, and we work directly with FHWA.
Yeah, a couple of things. You said, and I know we're at 30%, so you may be vague on this because we're not at 60 or 90, but you said at some point that west will cross over to the east. Do you know where it will happen yet and how?
The multi-use path comes up on the west side up to Clearview. On the north side of Clearview at Carson, it crosses, and then we'll go up the east side.
And how?
With a crosswalk.
With a light?
Yes, it's at the it's at the signal at Clearview.
The same kind that we have on Stewart, that kind of,
yeah,
with the light and then flashes. Okay.
Well, because the Clearview is a signalized intersection, it'll be the traditional, you know, stop, walk, don't walk. It won't be a rapid flashing beacon like you do at an unsignalized intersection.
And I'm still a little vague in my mind about you're talking two lanes south from the roundabout of Stewart and one lane north? I don't understand what you're saying.
If you're heading north into the roundabout, and this is all like the designer got on a little bit late with the roundabout design, so they're kind of playing catch up. So I want to kind of caveat is that this is preliminary, but the plan is you would essentially have, you know, if you were heading northbound into the roundabout, one lane, what we're looking at is a sweeping right there. So kind of like what it is today, we would try to keep that sweeping right. And that's where that lane heading northbound would drop off, is at that sweeping right. And then the other lane would basically go into the roundabout and go north. And that's where that lane would drop off, is what we're planning on there.
Further south. Two lanes going south.
There's two lanes south of the roundabout. There's two southbound lanes, two northbound lanes, and a center turn lane.
So you have.
Anything get lost in this because of what you said? I'm a little confused because they're, what, six lanes now? It's going to five? What do you say?
The
six lanes to five? Or what? I don't get. I can't get the picture.
Yeah, so.
Is it six lanes?
It's seven lanes.
Yeah, so seven lanes basically into five. And I guess the easy way to think about it is, one of those lanes that we're dropping off will basically turn into a multi-use path, and the other lane that we're dropping off will turn into a landscape buffer area. That's kind of where those two lanes, how it goes from seven to five. Does that kind of answer your question?
Well, you sounded at one point like you were saying that some of the landscaping was going to go. You sounded like at one point the landscaping was going to go away.
The landscaping, I know what you're talking about. Landscape buffer north of the roundabout goes away.
Okay.
That is because initially the design, we had one northbound, one southbound, and one center turn lane, so three lanes total. So we had enough room to provide those landscaping buffer areas between the road and the bike path. But because we did further traffic analysis and we want to make sure we're providing an adequate level of service, we had to add a southbound lane. And so because we added that, we just physically did not have the room to have those landscape buffers anymore.
Finally, what would the width of the single lane roundabout be? You were saying I assume it'd be fairly wide. You want it to move quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I think the standard width is just, it's a lane width essentially for the sink. When you're actually going around the roundabout, it's a 12-foot minimum,
right, Tom?
Yep. 12-foot minimum lane width, just like you would see other places.
Thank you.
I have one question. So you had two
my voice carries. Dan, you had two public meetings within 6 months apart. So tell me the input and the attendance of those meetings from the public to share their thoughts and ideas, please.
Yeah, I was actually not at the city at that time, but I can talk what I know. So the attendance was actually, I've heard that they were some of the best public meetings. I don't know, Court, were you there? That we've actually had. I've heard from like 80 to 100 people, which is pretty good for a public meeting. What happened at those meetings, and Court, you can get in at any time to correct me, but my understanding is projects were presented. Everybody had a maybe not everybody, but people had the opportunity to provide like a voting button, basically, and they were able to vote on different features that they wanted. And so at both of these meetings, I think there was voting, and then they could also fill out a note card or provide feedback on other comments that maybe weren't voted on. But the city compiled all this voting, like yes, no, and, you know, do you like this street section versus this street section, yes or no? And then based on those results, that's kind of formed basically the ultimate plan. What you're going to see when it's built is based off that feedback. So I think, yeah, like I said, I think both were heavily attended. I think from the city standpoint, we would consider those, you know, very successful public meetings where we gathered a lot of feedback.
For our standards, they were very well attended at those meetings. Yeah. Any other comments? Any public comments? All right. Thanks, Dan. We look forward to seeing what you have to bring us in January.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, moving on to agenda item 3C, presentation discussion, presentation by Jim Bertolini. And I don't know if, Lee, do you want to bring us into this one first, or do we want to, or Hope, or?
Hope Sullivan, planning okay. manager. I'll introduce Jim Bertolini and Kristen Brown. Jim is a historian with the State Historic Preservation Office, and Kristen's an architectural historian. One of the priorities of the SHPO's office, which is State Historic Preservation Office, has been the federal tax credit program and trying to inform the various communities about the availability of this program, about SHPO's role in helping property owners who are rehabbing historic properties take advantage of this federal tax credit. And so we thought it was something that would appeal to both groups. So we're grateful they were able to join us tonight. And
well, since I see everybody back, I guess we can cut our five-minute recess to 3 minutes and continue on if you guys are ready.
All right. Thank you, Hope. Again, my name is Jim Bertolini. I'm a historian with the State Preservation Office, and I do have a role in the Historic Tax Credit Program, but most of that is carried out by Kristen Brown next to me, our architectural historian, who will talk a little bit more about the program. And so I throw this up, this slide, just to let you know, SHPO does a lot of different, oversees a lot of different programs. In the previous presentation, you heard a little bit about our regulatory role with federally supported projects. That's another thing that Kristen takes care of. We have grant programs, including special grants that Carson City qualifies for being a certified local government, having a federally certified historic preservation program. Things like the National Register of Historic Places, et cetera. I won't spend too much time here. I'm really here just to kind of kick off this meeting. I know a lot of, just to talk a little bit about the purpose of preservation and what some of these buildings can do, what the purpose behind the Historic Tax Credit Program is. And then I'm going to try and move through this fairly quickly so that Kristen has more time to actually talk about the Historic Tax Credit Program and how it works. So I know for some of you, this may be very familiar concepts So for historic preservation, what is it and why do it? There's a lot of different definitions to this, but generally they all circulate around the same core concepts that historic places provide a sense of place, places that have unique character, places that speak to a community's identity, what sets it apart from other communities, why people might want to live there or invest in that community. I'll talk a little bit about the economic value that preservation pays. It's also has a role to play in creating environmentally sustainable communities. And I think one of the core misconceptions about preservation is that it's about halting change and keeping things kind of under glass. And that's really not what you're going to hear from us tonight. Preservation, especially in what we deal with, is about managing change. We expect change. It's going to happen. But how do we carry forward and still maintain historic character, still maintain that community identity as we go ahead? So, in terms of sustainability, I like to think broadly on three different concepts of sustainability. Speaking about sustainable social networks, just our sense of feeling like neighbors, I guess, would be another way of putting that. And historic places and historic buildings have a strong role to play in that because these are places that have stories attached to them. And especially for folks that may be multi-generational residents of Nevada or Carson City, these are often places that you've got memories going back decades. And as a result, those tend to be places that people want to be and want to take care of. I think we heard that in our first presentation tonight with Mr. West stepping up and taking care of Jack's Bar because he knows it's an icon for the community and wants to be a part of that. In terms of environmental sustainability, it's just that buildings are our largest consumer product. They take a lot of time, a lot of resources, a lot of energy to put together. So in a lot of cases, the greenest building is in fact the one that's already standing and put together. A lot of these buildings actually perform very well, including masonry buildings tend to perform very well on the LEED spectrum if you're familiar with leadership in energy efficient design. It's a national certification program, and it's very possible to score well with historic buildings as part of that program. And they also have a role to play in maintaining walkable and bikeable communities. And in terms of economic sustainability, especially with our smaller commercial buildings and residences, they promote local job growth in part because they usually sustain local businesses because they're smaller, adaptable spaces. But also, especially for maintenance projects, those tend to be things handled by local contractors who circulate their paychecks in a local economy. And, of course, there are financial incentive programs available. We're going to talk about the federal one, but I believe Carson City also has its own preservation incentive program. So what is preservation's role in broader economic development? It's fairly broad, in part. Existing buildings can sometimes be cheaper to rehab than demolition and new construction. It's not true every time, but frequently if you actually factor in the costs of demolishing and landfilling a building and then the new construction, rehab will be cheaper in a lot of cases, and especially if you leverage the incentive programs that are available like the one we'll talk about tonight. Historic commercial areas in particular tend to be more dense. Buildings are packed closer together. They were built at a time when our primary mode of transportation was walking, so they're built to be close together to make walkability more possible. And they also depended on being able to fund themselves financially. There weren't grant programs to go replace a sewer line or replace street systems, and so the tax base had to support the infrastructure by itself. Again, they're adaptable spaces for small businesses, and of course, because they already have their own stories, they lend themselves to marketing for heritage tourism efforts. Oh, in terms of that infrastructure efficiency, I like to hammer that point home a little bit. This is two different photographs. Above that red line is a section of Colfax in Colorado. This is a city I used to work for as a preservation specialist. And the north part of, or the upper photograph, shows the west end of Colfax in Aurora, the older portion that was built in the 1890s. And the section below that line is a few hundred yards to the east and more of a post-World War II 1970s through the 90s when most of that development happened. You'll notice on the upper part that 1890s development, it's very dense. Buildings are packed together. Parking's on the street. So this historic area is being a lot more efficient. You've got a lot more business activity in a smaller amount of acreage. If you look at the lower photograph, you've got a lot of newer development, and you see some of those parcels, they're two-thirds parking and one-third actually productive space. And some of them, the setbacks for parking are so big that you can't actually see the buildings that those parking lots are servicing. And if folks are familiar, this is a nonprofit that I steal from quite a bit, Strong Towns, just to hammer that point home, that oftentimes historic downtown blocks that still have those buildings standing and still have businesses in them allow local governments to pencil out their finances a lot better than the low-density, newer development that we tend to have. So just trying to kind of reinforce that historic preservation is not just a quality of life measure, but it's an economic development factor as well. So, some of the key tools we use for historic preservation, one is just identifying what's a candidate. What are the good buildings to invest in and spend the time on? How do we take care of them after that? How do we plan for keeping those buildings around for the future? And then what treatment options and funding options are available, like the historic tax credits that we'll talk about. Our key tool for identifying what's worthy of preservation is the National Register of Historic Places. That's one of the programs I run for the SHPO. The National Register is the nation's official list of places worthy of preservation. That's an important phrasing for the next slide. It means they're considered in federal project planning. So with that South Carson project, Section 106 of the National Historic Preservation Act requires considering places that are eligible for this National Register in that project planning. There also might leverage financial incentives. Sometimes grants are available for National Register listed buildings. Tax incentives are another part of that. And we already discussed their role in sustainable community development. To be eligible, most things just need to demonstrate some kind of historic significance, which could be very broadly defined, but also have integrity to whatever historic period they have. So there's a certain level of architectural measurement that goes on in terms of how closely these buildings still reflect their history. Or places, it's not just buildings. The National Register does not do some things that are common misconceptions. And the key one is that it does not change existing property rights. And ultimately, it doesn't guarantee preservation. Some local governments, like Carson City, have ordinances that do protect resources that your own government designates as historic. And oftentimes, what is designated as historic under that ordinance is taken and as takes the National Register into advisement in what's worth protecting. But ultimately, the National Register itself is an honorary listing. It's meant to encourage people to preserve these resources. But for private owners, it doesn't require it. And I usually use the Mapes Hotel in Reno as my quintessential example, built in 1947. At the time, the largest and tallest hotel in Nevada, an architectural landmark for the state. It was listed in the National Register in 1993 for that importance. But the owner decided not to rehab it, decided not to use the incentive program we'll talk about in a second. And so on Super Bowl Sunday 2000, that's the bottom photograph here showing him imploding that in downtown Reno. So we hope and encourage local governments to kind of take ownership of their own historic resources. So Carson City, for example, is a certified local government. That means its preservation program has been certified by the National Park Service in meeting certain minimum requirements. The key takeaway for this is that it qualifies the local government for grants. And so Carson City has been a regular recipient, I think, since certification in 1987, I think you've received about $500,000 in preservation grants through our office for various types of projects. Specifically to what we're talking about tonight, that may be survey to identify additional commercial buildings that might be eligible for the tax credit program, and also drafting nominations to the National Register. So they're worth thinking about in terms of takeaways for this evening. So this evening, one of the key incentives we have available for encouraging historic preservation is the Federal Historic Preservation Tax Credit. This is a 20% tax credit on most costs of rehabilitation. Kristen will go into more of the eligibility and what's required to secure that 20% credit. This is a federal program that's been around since 1976. And it's since that time leveraged billions of dollars in private investment in historic buildings. In Nevada, it's been underutilized for a lot of reasons. For one thing, it's a federal program. Those are always going to see a little bit less use in the American West just because of the requirements and the paperwork involved of meeting that. But one of the other key things is awareness, which is why we're very grateful for Hope's invite tonight to let you know about this this program. It has been used in Nevada. Our most recent tax credit project was for opening a small business in Genoa. If you're familiar with the Pink House that's downtown in Genoa, that's our most recent successful tax credit project that secured 20% back on just over $1 million project to rehab that building. So that's one of our pride and joy stories that we like to talk about. With that, I'm going to transfer this over to Kristen, who's going to talk to you a little bit more about the mechanics of the tax credit program and how it actually works.
Sure. Okay, thanks, Jim. So in order to qualify, first things first, you have to identify the project as a worthy historic, you know, resource. And how the tax credit program does that is through that National Register. So the property has to be listed in the National Register to qualify for the program, and it can either be listed as an individual resource, a standalone building that's just listed all by itself on its own merit, or it can be listed as part of a historic district and be a contributing resource to that district. So you have the big, you know, West Side District here. If you have some homes that are, I know that there's a lot of businesses that used to be residential properties that are now used as offices or as businesses. If one of those is a contributing resource to that National Register listing, that building would be considered listed and therefore eligible for this program. So it also, the building that you're going to rehab through this program also must be income producing. So like here on the slide, you know, it could be office space, it could be rentals, most commonly used for commercial purposes, anything like that. As long as it's income producing, it'll qualify. It'll usually qualify, I should say. And then one of the big ones is that the project itself, the scope of work for the rehabilitation project, needs to meet the Secretary of the Interior standards for rehabilitation. And I'm going to talk about that as well. So basically that number three means let's make sure the building is going to be rehabbed in a way that honors its historic characteristics, right? We're not going to totally change it. So in order to go through the tax credit project, it's a three-part application, and some people get scared. They think it's this whole very involved and difficult process. It's actually not that hard, especially if you start early, and I'm going to say start early like three more times before I stop talking. So the first part is the part one is the evaluation of significance. If your building is already listed in the register, or if it's already a contributing member of a district that's listed in the National Register, the part one is really easy. It's just getting a certification from Jim that says, yes, it's listed. If your building is not yet listed, you would work with Jim to find out if it's eligible. And there's a certification that needs to go, you know, you will have to do a little bit of early legwork, looking up the history of it, providing photographs, talking about its level of integrity, and so on. And if Jim and the Park Service feel that the building is indeed eligible for listing, you get the rubber stamp on your part one, and you're allowed to finish listing the building while you're working on the part two. You don't have to wait until it's actually listed in the National Register. I mean, because that can take like a year or something. So you, as long as you get that signed document that says it is eligible for listing, you can then go forth and begin hire your consultant to write the nomination and get it listed at the same time that you and your architect are working on the plan. So that's a good thing to do. So part two is the biggie. Part two is the description of your proposed work. So generally, that is done in concert with an architect or sometimes a structural engineer if you're doing seismic work. It can be your contractor if you're doing minor work. Whoever needs to help develop your scope of work, you would work with our office really early in the process before you do any work, and we would get that all typed up on the form, photos, sort of like before photos. We would get all those ready to go. Drawings, if you have them. Any supporting documentation, if you know what your building looked like historically and you want to bring it back to that, well, then put that old photo as part of the packet so we understand what it's going to look like again.
We just get the scope of work typed up. The key in this step is to, once again, to make sure that your project meets the Secretary of the Interior standards, which we will talk about in a minute. And once our office and you can agree on a project scope that meets those standards and everyone's happy, we submit it to the National Park Service for them to sign off on it as well. They are reading it to see if it meets the standards. So if I've done my job, it should be fine at the Park Service. Every once in a while, they might come back and they have a question or they need some clarification or something like that. But the more thorough job we do up front, the better. And once they sign off on your scope of work, then you go crazy and you do your project. And you just, you know, document along the way, take pictures during document and all of that. And then at the very end, when you're done with your construction, you take your after photos and you type up if there was any issues or problems or success stories. We kind of type that up, and that becomes part of the part three, which is essentially just proving that you did what you said you were going to do. And we often would come and do a walkthrough of your building with you, and if it all looks good, send it to the Park Service, and they get the final say on if they believe that what was done matches what was proposed, and they sign off on the part three. And then once you get that part three certification is when you and your tax professional can work with the IRS to get the 20% tax credit on your qualified expenditures. So our office does not deal with the money part of it. We're not actually allowed to, but even if we were, we wouldn't. that's not our expertise. But the IRS has a tax person who is the point of contact for the federal preservation tax credits. And she can be put in contact with your own tax professional, and they can hash out all those details together. So just a general overview of working with historic buildings. Of course, you want to know, why is it special? What is its history? What is its story? Does it have any particularly interesting character-defining features architecturally that might want to be preserved? You always want to keep in mind that you need to, you know, retain those historic building materials and those character-defining features whenever you can, because if you go taking them all off, you're not really, you know, you don't have anything left of your historic building. So the Secretary's standards always remind you to repair rather than replace historic building materials if possible. Planning ahead, again, don't start working on your project and then come to us 6 months later and you've already ripped out a bunch of stuff or what have you, because it's very likely that you would not qualify for the program. We really have to see the before, during, and after, and we really have to help develop that scope of work to make sure it's kosher. So always plan ahead, always ask questions. So just a general summary. The Secretary of the Interior standards is basically four different sets of standards. There's a set for reconstruction, which is exactly what it sounds like. If the building or other structure is no longer present, reconstruction is exactly that, reconstructing it based on historical documentation. There's restoration, which is if you have this wonderful, wonderful historic resource that has a high level of integrity, and you're simply restoring the materials and restoring the appearance to a certain time period, to how the building looked during a certain time period. That would be the set of standards for restoration. And then we also have a set for preservation, which is a building that has even better integrity and is pretty much all there, and you're trying to halt deterioration and preserve what's still there. And so preservation and restoration are a little stricter because we are, you know, trying to make the building look historically accurate, right? We see that a lot in things like house museums or, I don't know, what can you think of other
historic parks?
Yeah, parks, maybe if you go to Savannah, Georgia, or someplace that, you know. But then we come to rehabilitation, which is a set of standards that is the appropriate set for these tax credit projects. And this set of standards is the one we choose when we want to adaptively reuse a building. So we have a nice historic building, and we need to put maybe a new use into it or bring it up to modern day usage and needs. And we want to preserve as much of the historic character as we can, but we understand there needs to be a little bit of alteration. This is the set of standards that we use. So the standards, each set of standards has 10 standards. It's a list of 1 through 10. Some of the standards are common between all sets, right? And some differ depending on the set and use. But despite there being a list of 10, it kind of boils down to just a few basic principles that this set is trying to tell us. One I already mentioned, you want to retain and repair historic building materials and other character-defining features and any significant spaces of the building. You want to retain those rather than replace those. If something is deteriorated beyond repair, it cannot be repaired, and replacement is necessary, you want to replace in kind. You want to replace with like materials that have the same appearance. Even though we're going to change the use of a building, it's always important to retain its historic character. That could be, say the building historically is its main defining feature was that it had one big open space on the interior. Well, it wouldn't really be appropriate to go and chop that up into a bunch of small offices or hotel rooms because that would not be preserving the historic character of the building. You would want to find a new use for that building that allowed you to work with the existing character of that building. And then additions and alterations are allowed. They need to be compatible. They need to be differentiated somewhat from the historic, so you don't try to fool anyone and make them think that that addition was there for forever. So you want to set it apart just a little bit. And then, of course, you want your addition to be tasteful and maybe tucked away at the back, not overwhelming the original building volume and that kind of thing. So the standards are necessary for different reasons. For one, it's just a common language that different preservation professionals and also architects and other people can refer to those standards, and if everyone keeps checking back with the standards and make sure that what they're doing is meeting the standards, it just provides that nice baseline. And then that leads to consistency. Although some of the standards might be a little bit subjective sounding, the basic principles of them are pretty obvious, and so it does help reduce subjectivity just a little bit. Sometimes the standards are legally required. If you're just a private building owner and you want to fix up your building and you're not trying to get the tax credits and you're not trying to get a grant from our office you're not doing a federal undertaking through Section 106, well, then you don't have to follow the standards unless you want to. Yeah, but there are instances in which the standards are legally required. And then the standards are also really good because they do have a little bit of a long view. How can we minimize long-term effects to a building? So the standards don't just cover a building. They can cover a site like a historic park or an object like a old sculpture or something. They can cover both building exteriors and interiors, which I will note is different than your own local review process. For the local commission here, you, I believe, only review building exteriors. Is that correct? So the standards, if you are applying for the federal tax credit, you do have to consider interiors. You don't have to always preserve them pristinely, not all parts of them anyway. Like I say, you want to keep the character-defining features, but that doesn't mean you can't do some adaptive reconfiguring here and there. And then sometimes, depending on the project and depending on the level of historic significance and existing integrity, the standards could even include part of the setting and landscape if that was part of the historic feature of the property. So rehabilitation, like I say, different than preservation, different than reconstruction, et cetera. It is keyed toward adaptive reuse. How can we put modern uses into an old building successfully? Rehabilitation is a good thing to do if we do have a little bit of loss of integrity already in the building and we have to do, you can mix and match. You can do a little bit of reconstruction here, a little bit of preservation here, and a little bit of rehabilitation here. And then if you need to do some kind of additions or alterations, for example, reconfiguring some interior spaces or what have you, the set of standards for rehabilitation does allow for that. It is a little bit more lenient in terms of replacement of materials. But overriding idea is that you still are wanting to protect and maintain any important historic materials. So again, tips. So we have some tips from our office and from the Park Service. Definitely, before you even start filling out a bunch of forms, you should talk, have your tax professional make sure that you qualify for the money end of the project, because even if your building is listed on the National Register, you still have to meet a certain threshold for what the adjusted value of the building versus what the use is and the income and what how much money you're going to be spending on your rehabilitation. There's a formula. So that is something that your tax person can help you make sure that that's going to be okay. And then if possible, it's nice to hire contractors that do have some experience interpreting the secretary standards, or at the very least working with historic buildings and understanding that common language just a little bit. If you contact us early in the planning process, we can help sort of guide some of your ideas toward ones that would be in jive with the standards. And then, of course, don't assume, in terms of reviewing it and getting your documentation in order, don't assume that the review process at the local level can't stand in for our review process. Ours is going to ask you different things. That doesn't mean that what you prepare couldn't be presented to both, of course, but just they are separate processes. And then tips from our recent applicant, her tips are to just take a ton of photos and keep them really well organized and really well labeled before, during, and after. It's nice to label them and key them. You're ultimately going to need to key those to a site plan and to a floor plan so you know exactly where you were standing in the hall pointing the camera. So just keep everything really organized. And then just to keep in mind that although there are strict guidelines to the program, there's room for negotiation, there's room for flexibility, and there's room to achieve a really good project while still preserving the building. And then getting that 20% tax credit back is huge. So I'll try to keep going really fast so we don't stay here all night. But so common questions and common concerns that we get from people: what about exterior? What about windows and stuff? What about my interior spaces? How much can I reconfigure? What do I have to save? Can I put additions on? How can I get ADA access to my building? And most of those concerns are easily achieved if everyone keeps an open mind. So a bit about energy performance. Like Jim said, historic buildings can become very efficient and even achieve LEED certification. It's really great to do an energy audit so you can find out what your specific building's problems might be in terms of energy, because every building is different. There's no one, you know, one fix-all for every building in terms of weatherization and whatnot. It's probably really hard for you to read that picture on the bottom, but it's talking about, so this is a sample energy audit that someone might have had, talking about where they're losing their energy. If, I don't know if you can read it, but it says 31% of their air leaks were coming from floors, walls, and ceilings, 15% ducts, 14% fireplace, 13% plumbing penetration, and then we get to only 10% windows and 11% doors. So that kind of tells you, where do I need to put my money? Is it worth doing A when B is so much more cost-effective to be able to reduce, heat loss, what have you? Insulation is always a big bang for your buck, caulking and weather stripping, sealing those penetrations. If that's not enough, we often have options like storm windows or UV film for old windows to be able to keep those. And then this, it says solar and wind. Just don't forget that there are other ways to try to save energy costs down the road long term. So like we said, windows, we always want to remind building owners that since the standards ask to repair before replacing, you should not replace your historic windows. The vast majority of historic windows are actually made a lot better than any are made today. They're really good quality wood. They were built to last for a very long time. And the most of what we see, they're very repairable. There's only been a couple cases in my career that I've ever seen a window that was actually not repairable. The old, especially the wood sash windows, are so easy to pop out and rehab. And then if the if the building owner is seeking energy savings, they can do it different ways. Like I said, the majority of heat loss actually occurs around the window, not through the glass anyway. So there's a misconception probably perpetuated by new window manufacturers that says that you have to have double pane and all this kind of stuff. That is not really true. So if you want to save energy around your windows, you're going to want to repair the windows so they fit tightly and properly and that they're in good, solid, sound shape, and then caulk and weather strip. If absolutely necessary, there are ways to introduce storm windows. We've seen some successful interior storms. Those are always really nice because they do not change the appearance of the building from the outside. And then, like I said before, films or screens can also help with energy efficiency. If you do have to replace a window due to it being deteriorated beyond repair, because the standards say you have to replace in kind, it means that you pretty much, in a really old building, you're kind of looking at custom-made windows, which becomes massively expensive, which is another great reason to repair your windows. Replacing in kind to a historic building, they don't make stock sizes for those windows anymore. You have to go through a special company. You're gonna have to get them to look divided light, the right profile of the muntins, the right proportions, that kind of thing. So it is possible, and we've seen some really nice replacements that look really good. But it is not cheap. So interior, the federal tax credit program, like I said, it does consider interiors, but in general, it considers the main public spaces of a building. So that would include something like a lobby or a ballroom or an elevator lobby, a nice one, maybe, and then, of course, the main circulation networks, like a hallway. And those are kind of generally the interior spaces that this tax credit program focuses on. I've not in Nevada, but other places where I've lived, I've seen a lot of buildings, much like the one pictured here, that were able to retain that hallway and even the pattern of the doors and windows going down the hallway, but then totally rearrange the rooms on either side of the hallway to make it so maybe old tiny hotel rooms became modern size hotel rooms, or office space became really easily like open, so people could bring cubicles in or what have you. So it's very possible to introduce modern uses. And then same with secondary spaces of a building, basement spaces, staff work areas, kitchens, a lot of the utilities, closets and stuff like that are also often able to be reconfigured to introduce, you know, ADA compliant bathrooms or whatever the owner needs to have in their building. So like this slide says, we just want to avoid altering the main appearance of the main public spaces. Features and finishes goes back to the main part of the standards. You want to retain historic building materials that have historic character. If they are deteriorated, you want to replace them in kind. And then this is just kind of a reminder that you never know, a historic building material might exist under something that someone slathered on top of it at some point. And one of the other standards is, of course, to not create a false sense of history. And I mentioned that earlier. You're not trying to fool anyone. If the interior of a building was originally intended to be, say you have your auto garage and then you had your showroom and offices, if those front spaces were originally meant to be very finished looking because they were the public spaces, and then the back was the rough kind of exposed brick space, it would not be appropriate to put exposed brick throughout the whole front because that would be creating a false sense of history. So those are just kind of some very basic guidelines for interiors. Like I said, additions, they're possible. You have to do a little bit of research to find out if it can accommodate an addition in terms of not only its scale and appearance and where it happens to be located, but also structurally if the building can support an addition. Additions are okay as long as they're compatible with the building, and that means, you know, setback, size, scale. They can't overwhelm the original building volume, that kind of thing. Like I said before, differentiation of the materials so that you're not trying to pull an over on anyone that this is an old part of the building. Obviously, no front additions. And then for ADA, there are a lot of creative ways that you can introduce accessibility into a historic building. Of course, we like to see similar. We like to have everyone be able to have access to the building the same way, and if it works out to be in the front or one of the main entrances, that's always a great thing. But if worst case scenario, if they have to use a side entrance, that is often an acceptable solution, as long, you know, to the historic structure of the building. We've seen ramps, we've seen lifts, interior lifts, exterior lifts, and there's actually a preservation brief, number 32, and you guys have some of these briefs in your packet, and Jim passed out additional. There's one that talks about ADA, and it's a really good resource just to get some ideas for ways you can tackle that. Seismic is a really big deal here, of course, in Nevada. There's also a preservation brief for talking about seismic work. So just like with anything, you want to start early, you want to do your planning, you want to hire people that know what they're doing and know about historic buildings, and then really just figure out what's needed for the building and for its use, and then try to figure out how you can, if possible, make your bracing compatible. And we don't need to go into that a whole bunch because that's very case-by-case basis, but the point to take away is that it is possible to do seismic upgrades to historic buildings. Okay, I just raced through all that. So summary, you can do this.
Sure. hopefully we've provided kind of a window into this redevelopment program. It's really popular in a lot of other communities, especially to revitalize downtowns. It's frequently incorporated into an urban renewal authorities program, specifically because a lot of these historic buildings are underutilized. And so this can sometimes be the way to help those projects pencil, secure bridge funding, things like that. So I will say we're available. We do have our business cards out at the front, which I can leave here. And we can talk. Kristen's always available to talk about projects if you set up an appointment with her ahead of time. If you have a historic building here in Carson City that might be a good candidate for this program. I'm always available as well, especially if it's a building that's not in the National Register yet. I can help you screen if it might be eligible for that. And I can also help you in terms of the Certified Local Government Program, scoping out a grant project that might help survey on a larger scale what might still be eligible, what commercial buildings might be good candidates for this program that would be good to proactively get into the National Register in advance of an owner trying to do this project. So with that, we can answer questions, but I'll give this back to Hope.
Any questions from either commission?
I just had one question. How many tax projects do you have ongoing right now currently?
We do not have any right now, sadly. We have some interest from a few building owners across the state. We keep a file of people who have contacted us with questions. We often send links to read more, and we give them some of the basic information that I just presented to you guys. And so we have some people out there pondering it, but we actually don't have any right now, which is a bummer because I moved here from Texas, and there's a ton of tax credit projects going on at any given time there. And I also did a little bit of work with tax credits in Oregon, and there's a decent number going on there as well. So I feel like we need to spread the word that it's a great program.
What kind of a time frame is there from start to not necessarily finish, but
that's a great question. I think Jim is probably better to answer this because he did the one most recently, but I think sadly the answer is it totally depends on the size scale of your project. Wait a minute. We do have one going on. I take that back. I apologize. We do have one going on. I just haven't received his revisions yet, so the Park Service doesn't have it yet. It's up in Virginia City. It's the Silver Dollar Hotel, right? Right. Silver Dollar Hotel. He has completed his Part 1 certification that his building contributes to the district up there, and he sent me his first iteration of his Part 2 with his scope of work, and I asked him for just a couple minor revisions, and he is getting those back to me. So I apologize. We do have one going on. But so this project in Virginia City is very straightforward. It's a small project. It's a small building. He's not going crazy. He's not doing seismic work or an addition or anything like that. He's basically just keeping the exact form of the building, and he's restoring, more or less restoring it and doing some maintenance and doing some roofing and stuff like that. So his scope of work was very easy. He's not working with an architect. So he was able to type it all up himself, and I was able to review it very quickly on my end. And now the ball is in his court again, of course. So once he gets me that back, I'll already know that it's fine because I looked at the first draft, and I'll be able to immediately send that to the Park Service. And then they have, 45 days or something?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and so in terms of timing, I think usually the limit is 48 months from when you first submit that first part one to when you're dropping off your part three and filing that with the Park Service. You can sometimes get an extension for that, especially for larger projects. But yeah, usually how that application, if you remember that three-part application, each part gets submitted and usually has a 60-day review period, 30 days with SHPO, 30 days with the National Park Service before you get a response. But if we do have to request more information, that'll extend each one of those periods until that moves forward. So,
right.
So generally 48 months is what you're, or sorry, not 48 months, 24 months. I'm sorry, 2 years. I can do math this late at night. So 24 months or 2 years as a typical project period to work with.
And I think if you're building, if you have a gigantic building that you're doing all kinds of work to and you have huge sets of architectural drawings and we're doing multiple meetings with your architect, you know, we're doing early scoping meetings, we're doing walkthroughs, they're giving me 30% drawings, they're giving me 60% drawings and all of that, of course that's going to take a lot longer. But Like I said earlier, that can all, if your building is not yet listed, that can all be happening at the same time that you are writing or hiring someone to write the National Register nomination. And that process also could take a year, but again, once you get your ball rolling, you're good, you know. I hope that's not a very good answer, but.
Any other questions? Jim and Kristen, thank you very much for your presentation.
Thanks.
This time I'd like to open up for any public comment before we look at adjourning the evening. Oh, do we? What did I miss?
The very last one.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, Lee. I went right past you. 3D presentation and discussion to give an overview of the redevelopment facade improvement program. Lee.
So just talk a little bit briefly about the facade improvement program. This is mostly for the Historic Resource Commission in question, kind of bring them up to date on what's been done and what the program is. The Citizens Committee spoke at length about it at their last meeting in November and are well aware of what the program is. But it is it's a grant, basically. We say you can't sell it within 1 year or you pay the money back, but it's basically a grant of funds, a program that was implemented in 2016. So we've had it in place now and up and running for about 2 years and a half. And I have a map at a couple slides from now showing all the properties that we've done so far. But it's been, over that time, a total of $187,000-plus awarded towards facade improvements. The program is a 50-50 match program. So the city will match 50% of the cost of the exterior facades up to a maximum of $25,000 per property. Well, I'm skipping down there. Eligible improvements, it's the what you know as a facade, the things on the building that you see from the exterior are eligible. It's not interior improvements aren't eligible, nor are signs, landscaping, or paving, or those other things under this program. So the properties that are eligible, currently the program says, and I'll pull up some maps here now, and we'll just move on to the next one there. So currently, all commercial properties within the redevelopment district are eligible. So there's some overlap here of those between our redevelopment districts, which are up there on the screen, and the historic districts. There's a little bit of overlap there. On the left there is the downtown district. If you can kind of orient yourself to that, at the Fairview is in the left picture there. Fairview's at the very bottom of that photo, and Carson Street goes up, and then the redevelopment district runs east down William Street to the end of Mills Park, just to kind of orient you there. And those, all those red shaded areas are the commercial properties within that district. And then from pretty much Stewart Street, on Carson Street heading south from Stewart Street all the way to the south is redevelopment area number two. And so commercial properties there are eligible. And I will note, as I had up on a bullet on the previous slide, actually Thursday at the Board of Supervisors meeting, they're going to be considering an amendment to the program to limit the eligible properties to just those along the Carson Street and future South Carson Street and William Street improvements. That'll be under consideration. I don't have a map of what that would look like for South Carson Street. That wouldn't change that area very much because most of those properties are along Carson Street through the downtown and along William Street. It would change that eligibility a bit. This shows an overlap downtown. You can see the historic district in the crosshatched area there, so how that overlaps a bit, quite a bit, with the redevelopment district in shaded in yellow. And this is a list of all the properties that we've done so far with the amount that's been awarded to the various properties. So you can see that even with all the eligible properties, really the focus has been of those that have applied buildings in the downtown. So most of them have been right along that commercial corridor, and there's just a couple that have been outside of that commercial corridor. And that's an overview of the program, and really just wanted to bring it up, and if anybody had any questions about that, this would be the opportunity to ask it and learn more about it. So that's all I had.
Thanks, Lee. I think our side's very familiar with this, but anybody have any questions regarding the facade improvement program?
I am wondering, it's kind of speaks a little bit to what Kristen and Jim were talking about. There are some facades on these buildings that you've given grants to, they are considered historic resources because they're at least 50 years old. So I'm wondering, what are the guidelines if the building is at least 50 years old to maintaining that streetscape view, which is important to Carson City?
So one of the requirements of the program is that they comply with the development standards, and within the development standards for downtown is rehabilitation of structures more than 50 years old, but those are not Historic Resource Commission standards. They are a little different, but there are some guidelines in there for cleaning, without looking at them, but like for rehabbing brick and things like that. But there aren't design guidelines. Like, so if the program itself, for example, doesn't trigger Historic Resource Commission review just because it's over 50 years old if it's not in the district. On the other hand, we've had a couple projects that did come before the Historic Resource Commission because they were in the district.
I guess my concern is that any other redevelopment zone of any place else that I live, mainly in Oregon and Pennsylvania, is that there's design considerations in the redevelopment program for resources over 50 years old, even if it's not in the historic district, that it's somehow a facade improvement is exactly that. That's the most important part of the facing the street. And I've seen things happen that I just question, new materials being introduced that aren't historically compatible with Carson City.
But I think your concern doesn't necessarily have to do with redevelopment. I think it's something that's happening to those properties, whether or not, it's not a matter of whether or not redevelopment paid for it. It's whether or not Carson City has standards for all structures that are over 50 years old versus only having those standards for properties within an established historic district. So I understand your concern. As the program set up, we're not treating a property any different than we would if they were coming in and paying for it themselves. That is how the program set up. We're not, it's not triggering a higher level of review than any other property. That is true how the, that is how the program set up.
I think the point is, though, that if without this grant money, they may not actually afford to do the development. And so in the way, you are allowing this to go forward. And so I think what Michelle is pointing to is that maybe we should have a few ties to that money so that when people come in that they have a chance to recognize what their facade elements are and how the design should work with that, rather than just having a clean slate and they can do whatever they want with money that is essentially the city's money, which represents all of us as taxpayers.
Leave it. I think as far as this program goes, there's no definition. It's not a historic versus a non-historic program. It's just a facade improvement for business owners in that corridor program. So whether it's a 20-year-old business or a 70-year-old business, I think that's our mandate at this point. I mean, I think we're talking a couple, two different things here.
Would your committee be interested in working with us? I mean, we basically have the Carson Street, Curry Street corridor, and then we hit the historic district. And there's plenty of historic buildings there. And I think if we work together and recognize that there are some significant properties that probably shouldn't have a different facade put on. It should be a lot more compatible with what's around them. And if, yeah, I think with tonight's SHPO's presentation, if you guys just have that in mind when you're reviewing these and can kind of direct an applicant that, you know, maybe putting up this tile front, storefront, isn't appropriate for what was there historically, it would work really well. I don't know that we need it as a hard design standard, but it's just something that you know, we would be happy to work with you and, you know, something to consider as they're doing it, so we can keep that continuity, because I think that's what we're starting to see downtown is we're getting new facades that don't necessarily mimic what was there or even complement what was there before.
Yeah, I think it's something that I think as we take in applications, if there's because we obviously have buildings that are more than 50 years old and much more, but are not in the district. And if there's, and we have design standards that acknowledge that, and we should be acknowledging it. So, I think we can start off by taking a closer look internally to see to maybe help that applicant do something that's more appropriate. And
I think if you're weighing two projects and somebody's coming in with an historic building and wants to rehab that historic storefront, that should carry more weight than somebody who wants to tear it down and put up aluminum or something else.
But also think, to Lee's point, you know, there should be a checklist of something before they come to the RAC committee about the facade program based on what the historical committee just stated earlier, to see will they qualify to come before the RAC to ask for funding to improve such a program if those funds are set aside and can be worked with the historical committee based on the years, based on the work that needs to be done. Because I heard here, we talked about windows, we talked about glass, we talked about other things, but I didn't hear anything about roofing and things of that nature too. So if your committee, if they can come before you first, before they come before the RAC, to make sure that they have covered all that basis. You see the point I'm making?
I also liked Jim's suggestion about doing a survey on the commercial buildings that could be eligible. I think that would be extremely helpful.
Yeah, I was going to offer that. If you guys would be interested in doing the at least the Carson-Curry Street corridor, as do an inventory of those buildings, we could apply for certified local government funding to get that done. And we've done it all on the west side. We did it for the historic district. And that would actually help, because you wouldn't, if we did that as the downtown Carson City Commercial District, and it was a registered district, we have contributing buildings within them. you don't have to go to the individual listing. We could identify the important ones. And if a building owner or property owner wants to apply for those credits, that's done. And we could certainly, I mean, we've done it in the past. We did the east side. We've done a number of surveys on the west. And if you're interested, we'd be happy to put that on our list for this year's funding.
Those are all good ideas, Lee.
I have a question, probably for you, Lee. On some of the historic buildings, the steep pitch roofs, whether it's the Methodist Church, the Episcopal Church, the Brouillard Center, my office, is that eligible for this redevelopment facade program?
Roofs are not re-roofings. It was initially eligible. It's not an eligible improvement now. We've removed that.
And as far as from historic preservation, aren't we looking at roofs and things like that that have a steep pitch, not a flat roof like Comma Coffee or something that has, you know, that's not part of the facade, but as far as historic preservation looks, some of the steep pitch roofs like an old church would be part of the facade. Is that something that's worthwhile continuing on with, talking to you about? Because yes, I did get that for my roof, but I know it's not eligible anymore. Is that something that...
I don't think it was eligible then, but so...
But well, and you're absolutely right, but when you're looking at facade from historic preservation, it is. But we can also agree that the roof that was on there was pretty horrible. And without the facade improvement program, I would not have been able to afford to do that. So, you know, and part of redevelopment where you're trying to rehab and improve buildings so that their taxable value goes up and taxes are increased and going back into the revolving fund for redevelopment. I mean, that's kind of, you know, there's two sides of that sword as well. And I might say, Ronnie, you did vote yes for it, so thank you.
I know I did.
Anything else? Okay, now we'll open up for public comment again. Sorry for skipping you again, Lee. Absolutely. Yes, please.
Kristen Brown, what else do I need to tell you? Anything? Okay.
That's fine.
So I just had a couple ideas going along with your conversation. Other places where I've lived that had facade grant programs did have a review trigger that was only triggered if the grant was awarded. So it didn't mean that the city had to suddenly start reviewing everything over 50 years of age for every time somebody wanted to do something that to their non-district buildings. It was, as you kind of alluded to, only triggered by the grant itself. So another idea that I kind of had when Michelle was talking was about cumulative impacts to a downtown. And Mike was also kind of talking about the downtown as it exists right now and maybe having some additional identification effort to see if there might be a district present. Right now, as you know, downtown Carson City does have a lot of alterations to some of its storefronts. So if you want your downtown to become a historic district, the best way to do it is to put it more back toward having that integrity and that historic character. So you get to boost the number of contributing buildings, right? Because you can't have a historic district if you only have 30% contributing buildings, for example. So one idea that you could consider with facade grants would be some investigative work to see if maybe some of the original building materials are present underneath those false facades that some of the buildings have. So if someone's going to be spending money anyway on fixing up their facade and trying to invite customers into their business, it's a little gentle nudge toward trying to find out, doing some investigation as to how you might return it to a more compatible or historically appropriate appearance, might have not only a positive impact on that business, but it might also have a cumulative impact on the integrity of your streetscape as a whole, and therefore might tip the scales maybe toward eligible historic district versus not eligible due to lack of integrity. Does that make sense?
And those are the
I think most of the businesses downtown have already applied for it and have already remodeled, so I highly doubt that they're going to go backwards. So
sure, I understand. I guess I was just putting that out there in terms of just a.
So we have standards in our code now about that for the downtown, and then false facades and
sure.
Removing them. So our standards already encourage that. And I'd also take this opportunity for anybody that knows a property owner that has one of those that might have a nice historic facade under a false facade that
sure.
might be interested in the program to,
sure.
to come talk to us about it.
Yeah, good, for sure. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any additional public comment? Okay, thank you. Motion for adjournment.
Second.
All in favor. I think we're all in favor. Aye. Adjourned.